Welcome to Liberty Southwest podcast number 9. Tonight I am joined by Danny Ning and Eric Taylor. I am Matt Winterer. It's a short crew tonight, folks. However, it won't diminish the quality. Today we're going to be talking about left versus right paradigm and how the Liberty movement is affecting the relationship between the two and how it will play a role in the future. However, today I found out about something that is absolutely upsetting me. And it's the fact that the National Highway Transportation Safety Administration decided that you have to, starting in 2018, have a backup camera and sensors on the back of your car. I'm absolutely blown away by this. I think it's ridiculous that it's a requirement. It's going to raise the price of base stock cheap vehicles, and I think it's ridiculous. What do you guys think?
Yeah, this is really when I think I saw this on the news earlier today. It was the first I heard about legislation of this kind at all. Looking at an article and kind of lend some background as to what's going on. I guess the rule follows an outcry from consumer groups and by families touched by tragic backover accidents, especially those involving children. They have pushed hard against more delays in the rule, according to this article. Quote-unquote, we are committed to protecting the most vulnerable victims of backover accidents, our children and seniors, says Transportation Secretary Anthony Fox. Under the rule, all vehicles would have to give the driver a view 10-foot by 20-foot zone directly behind the vehicle. There are also requirements for image size and other factors that all but require rear view cameras as the only solution that complies. So apparently there's some accidents, according to this article, 210 people die, because of backup incidents a year in the United States. So that looks like the major lobby that was
210
through. Yeah.
Each year.
Yeah. Hundreds of millions of people live in the nation and 210 are dying, and they decide to pass legislation that essentially puts a tax on every single car buyer 2018 and beyond. To me, that is ridiculous.
Right.
It's like the cost is $132 to $142 for each system. That's the additional cost.
For a new vehicle. That's what it says. NHS TSA expected the system would cost $140 per new vehicle.
And if you look at that in an overall cost per life saved, or not per life saved, per life lost, who knows what the actual saving is going to be. But per life lost, that is a hell of a steep price that's passed on to the consumer for that.
And here's my question. Even if we install these rear-facing cameras, I'm questioning this. Is it really going to save, between 59, 69 deaths, whatever, per year? I mean, we have people have rearview mirrors already, side mirrors that they can look at. And if they install these rear-facing cameras, I mean, is that really going to do much? I mean, chances are these people who are, it's sad to hear that, they're trampling over their children, trampling over seniors. But, what is the real cause? Is it because they're not looking? So even if they're installing these rear-facing cameras, chances are they probably wouldn't be looking. I don't know. Maybe I'm not understanding something. Are these cameras going to, automatically tell you that someone is there?
So I think that's part of it. I think they want the automatic sensors that beep at you when you're packing up. However, you make a very good point. It's people who aren't looking behind them when they back up. It's not a huge problem. This is a small portion of the population, and now we're legislating vehicle design based on a small minority of the population that's not responsible enough. And I had a few people today comment to me that they're like, well, there's nothing wrong with having more vehicle safety. And my argument to them was, you know, well, then at that point, why don't you put a governor on all cars that stops them from going over 30 miles per hour? Why don't you put carbon ceramic brakes on all cars, which cost about $10,000 to $20,000 per car? Why don't you require Goodyear Eagle F1 GT supercar tires on all cars during the summertime? And why don't you require, additionally, 5-point racing harnesses and full roll cages in all cars at that point? I think the answer is that you can go overboard on what safety is. And trying to justify something like this just by saying we're going to make things safer is kind of a ridiculous thing in my mind.
Right. You know, this just popped in my mind. I wonder how many people riding bikes in, you know, cities like Minneapolis, and how many accidents have happened because, you know, it's required by law that they have to ride these bikes on the roads. They can't do it on the sidewalks. So, you know, obviously this, you know, I'm just wondering how many accidents per year, you know, that this happens, you know, as well as other states, yet, you know, it's a requirement that these bikes still being, you know, that they have to ride these bikes on the cities, you know. So kind of like the similar situation here, but I don't see anything going on with, you know, bike accidents. But, you know, I haven't done the research on bike accidents either. So, and I don't know. I'm guessing I'm just want to hear what you guys think about that.
Yeah, to me, it seems like you're trying to some extent, to legislate negligence, you know, in driving. And how do you really do that? I would guess the majority of these accidents are caused by inattention. You know, are you going to, yeah, just because you have, you know, video of what's going on behind you, is that really going to matter? I would question that. But in this article, it seems like when you have a lot of times when you have policy like this safety policy, you have a group of individuals that are really fired up by a series of incidents that are close to them. And so they, you know, they get very aggressive and do what they can to make sure a similar type of incident doesn't affect them or other individuals in the future. So for example, out of this article, what they mention is to try to break through, a coalition of car safety advocates and parents sued the Obama administration in September. Two parents who accidentally backed over children were the lead plaintiffs. The U.S. Court of Appeals in New York was scheduled to hear arguments Tuesday. Advocates expressed relief that the regulation had finally been issued. Quote unquote, it's about time the motoring public will finally be able to see what's behind their vehicle while backing up, says Jeanette Fennell, president of kidsandcars.org in a statement. So I can think of many examples where you get a fired up group that latches on to an outlier and pushes legislation and gets it successfully passed just because of their pure tenacity or aggressiveness behind their agenda. And to me, that's what this looks like.
Yeah, I don't know. It's just their own stupidity, in my opinion, and trying to make the world a better place by forcing this down our throats. I don't know. As you can see, I disagree with this, but you know, I'm sure you all do.
I guess it's interesting because when you talk about it from the perspective of we're doing it for this emotional response, I look at everything in life under this kind of plate. Let's just say I've got this window that says whenever somebody's doing something through emotion, that I have to temper it. The response is done based on something that's happened to them that's extreme. And anybody who's had something extremely traumatic happen to them is going to have a different perspective.
Absolutely.
On, yeah. So, and when you look at like a fire code, you don't want the chief of the fire department writing fire code, because he's the guy who sees a fire happening in every house every day. Whereas in reality, fires are extremely rare in homes, but the fire chief would say, I want a sprinkler system in every house, and that needs to be a requirement, because that's all that makes sense to that individual. You know, you might see him as being like even an expert, as you would the person who unfortunately backed over a child in their vehicle. They'd be a quote unquote expert in backing over someone. They have an emotional response that's much more extreme than the average person who's been responsible and not backed over someone, you know? And the perspective from that they have is far too extreme to create policy. Yet we've got lawmakers who are willing to sit down and say, no, this sounds totally legitimate, you know. And I don't understand why they're not willing to be more temperate about it and say, what are you? Are you kidding me? You're telling me that you want everybody else to pay this extra amount on their car? Every single person in the states, based on a number of deaths that's less than, I mean, I haven't taken the time to go out and find out how few that number is, but that's got to be in the infinitesimally small range of deaths a year in the United States, just insanely small as a percentage. It's something that I can't believe that we'd ever even focus time on for legislation.
Right. And, you know, I was thinking maybe, you know, instead of forcing every single car to include a rear view camera, maybe, you know, when a buyer signs a contract to buy the car, you know, if they really want to legislate something, you know, maybe this is a solution to include in the contract to mention that this clause saying, hey, if you have children, consider adding the option of adding a rear view camera. So then that way it lets the buyer know ahead of time, saying, oh, this car might not have a rear view camera. Should I consider getting this? Oh, I have children, you know, and sometimes I might not look behind. Yeah,
absolutely.
I'll do that.
So, absolutely.
You know, rather than forcing everyone to get a car that has a rear view camera, you know, maybe, you know, the dealer should, you know, if they really want to regulate this, you know, include like a clause saying, you know, every salesperson needs to bring this up to the buyer. I don't know. That's something to think about, that what they could potentially do. But, you know, just making everyone to having to have a rear view camera, I mean, that's outrageous.
Right. And I think you hit the nail on the head. I think if you are in a situation that you believe that you need this precaution, where you've got you have children and you're in that type of situation, this makes sense. If you want a camera on the back of your car, freaking option it out. It's there. It's available. You can buy a vehicle with those options on it. It's actually not even remotely uncommon. A lot of the $20,000 vehicles these days come with reverse view cameras. Now, however, being a 30-year-old single guy, I have a sports car. I don't need a rear view camera. I don't have children who play around the backside of my car. I look behind me. If there's nobody behind me, I'm not going to run them over. It's not, I mean, it's the frequency that there are children around my car are as frequent as I frequent a amusement park, and that happens maybe once every 2 years. I mean, it just doesn't happen. There aren't children around me. I mean, that's the reality of the situation, is you have two different types of situations. You're legislating everybody into one group, and now you're taking away the money of an entire huge group of people who don't have the same requirements as the people who would be benefited by having these rear view cameras, who already have the option.
Here's a statement that I'm reading right now. I'm just going to read this quote unquote. It also pledged to ask NHTSA to allow automakers to remove side view mirrors and replace them with cameras that may expand side vision while increasing fuel efficiency. I don't know. To me, this sounds like BS.
Are you serious? They want you to do that too? So now you need another screen on either side of the car. That's only going to decrease the price of a new vehicle by, you know, a lot of money. Because a reflective piece of glass costs a lot less than a display screen. You know, and what's gonna happen when you get car inspections in other states? I mean, I know it doesn't happen here in Minnesota, but plenty of other states have yearly car inspections. What's going to happen when one of those cameras not working? You know, okay, now you have to freaking replace the thing. And the manufacturer only puts one in that's going to last a little while, whereas a freaking mirror would last you a heck of a lot longer than a camera that's sitting there. I mean, we all work in a technologically sensitive environment. I mean, I work in IT, you work in banking, Danny, and Eric, you work in IT. All three of us are exposed to technology. We know how often this stuff fails. It's not like we've got a understood opinion of the entire technological reliability. This stuff happens, and now you've got an entire another thing for those people to worry about. Every day they get home from work and they're staring at this camera that's going to cost them more money because it failed, and you got to get it fixed before their next DOT impound session when they're trying to get their car through that.
Well, just imagine like a 3-year-old or 8-year-old just come behind with a baseball bat and just swack at the camera. I mean, imagine.
Yeah, you
I'm
know,
sure there's kids do that out there, like teenagers, and now you have to fix it. It's like, oh man.
Yeah, you know, and in reality, the children and other people they don't have the same kind of sympathy for that kind of thing, and you know, even maybe they're crazy like. People who just want to prove a point, and they're just going to run around and whack a bunch of cameras, you know, and they're upset about it. So they decide that they're going to crack a bunch of cameras. Now those people are screwed, you know. I hate this. I hate it quite a bit. I think this is entirely tyrannical. In the end, I believe it's tyrannical. I think that the government has totally overstepped its bounds, and, you know, even more than requiring cars to make 50 miles to the gallon in the very near future, I think this is even worse.
Yeah. No, I agree.
To me, it's just a real good example. Like, I'm sure you guys can think of other examples that are like this, of how a small group of people can get energized and immobilized based on an issue that's impacted them, you know, deeply. So it's hard for, you know, for anyone who hasn't been in that type of situation to understand, the emotion associated with that. But at the same time, I mentioned this earlier, you can't regulate attention. I mean, you can't legislate, correct decision making. We've only had, how long have we even had rear view cameras for? It's probably been for under 10 years.
You know? Under 10 for sure. I think 2003 Honda introduced one on the back of the Honda Odyssey.
Yeah.
I'm not certain if there was something before that or not. I know like motorhomes have come with them for a lot longer, but that was, you know, obviously because the motorhome's like 30 feet long.
Yeah. Yeah. So I don't know. It seems kind of silly, and to me, you never know. It could be just taken care of by the wonder of driverless cars in the next 10 years, you know, because those are the ability for, you know, a driverless car, the technology is already there, and hopefully it'll make a conversation like this just a moot point. You know, if you have someone who's not paying attention for whatever reason, just turn on your auto drive. And, you know, you won't run over anything.
Okay, I was totally wrong. The first backup camera was in a 1956 Buick Centurion concept car that had a rear-mounted television camera that sent television images to the TV screen in the dashboard. Nice. In place of the rear view mirror. Yeah, so it's been around for a while, but the widespread use is obviously not quite so common.
That would be cool to have something like that in the mid-50s.
Yeah. I guess in 2007, Nissan introduced their all-around monitor, which used four cameras to give you kind of like a bird's-eye view of the vehicle. The next vehicle that offered something similar was BMW, and it was in 2009. But they had this 5 Series vehicle that kind of offered the same thing. But aside from that, there hasn't been anything there. Otherwise, like I said, I think motorhomes are the first real vehicles to have that backup camera. But like I said, it's 34 feet long. And I have to laugh about this because personally I'm a member of a racing team, a National Point Series racing team. And we've got a motorhome. And on the back of the motorhome, we tow a 24-foot racing trailer. And the combined length is actually 53 feet long. So it's 3 feet longer than a semi-trailer-tractor combo. But the back view camera, all it shows you is the trailer that's behind you. So we have to drive this thing across the country with no rear view beyond what's in the mirrors. And it works fine. We've never come close to having any kind of a problem as far as driving it across the country. So, you know, I have a lot of personal experience dealing with long vehicles and not having a problem with as far as driving them without having a backup camera. So,
yeah, I think probably the three of us would agree that the impact of this legislation on deaths associated with backup incidents is probably going to be pretty minimal.
Right.
So
at this point, then, we've got this whole left versus right thing going on, and we'll call it a paradigm. Just based on the fact that left versus right is kind of an interesting conversation in itself, but we'll call it a paradigm for this point. And I thought it would be very interesting to talk about, and I think there's a few of us last week that we thought it'd be very interesting to talk about as far as how the liberty movement has kind of an influence on the relationship between the two and on each one as an individual, and how that will play a role going into the future as far as how the liberty movement will have an influence on those particular groups, the left and the right. And I think we've all got quite a few opinions on this. So why don't we start out this conversation in that direction?
Sure. I think, you know, Chelsea Camo has been on the show a few times, and she referred to the Democratic and Republican parties as being the government party. I think there are, you know, quite a few individuals that may relate to that, you know, quite a few that don't. I think we've, you know, the group here and others who've participated in the podcast in the past have all decided to use to participate in the Republican Party because it most closely matches our political beliefs, you know, fiscal conservatism, and in the classical liberal sense, social liberalism, you know, allowing everyone to do or anyone to do what they like to do as long as they don't negatively impact the safety or health of another individual. And I think, you know, that's what when you're talking about the liberty movement in general, those are the defining characteristics of the movement. It's a primarily, at least as it stands now, a skews towards the younger side, you know, as far as demographics are concerned, you know, has had a impact on the Republican side in varying degrees. And I don't know if you guys can speak to this, but that kind of fiscal conservatism, social liberalism, hasn't really had as much influence on the Democratic or the left side.
I think I would agree with that quite a bit. I think, but I have heard quite a bit on the social side of the libertarian movement that's the exact opposite of that. So I've seen a lot of the Democrat side supporting the gay rights, the legalization of drugs, that actually the complete elimination of the war on drugs altogether. That's a much more left centrist or a left centered ideal than it is coming from the conservative right side. So the people who I talked to, so I talked to somebody at work this week with an intention of kind of getting an idea of what the left view was, and that's his opinion. And I asked him about several things, and the things that he agreed with me on were all the social side of the equation. And so, based on what you've seen so far, I think we've seen two sides, and I think we kind of fall in between both of them. And I don't, you know, it's interesting because you kind of want to throw your hands up in the air and say, I'm so frustrated because we agree on so much. How is it possible that we've got such diametrically opposed teams? And I don't know what the actual why the we'll say Republicans and Democrats are so diametrically opposed to each other when they agree on some of the most fundamental things that the nation was founded on.
Right. Yeah, there are opportunities to bridge that gap. Imagine the individual that you spoke with is probably a proponent of government helping the less fortunate out in times of need.
Absolutely.
That's what you have. An important aspect to Democrats in general, liberals, specifically, is the need to help people out who are having a difficult time, and that's a difficult area to reconcile for fiscal conservatives and social liberals, or I should say, fiscally liberal people, and something where there's very little agreement, on the conservative side or the Republican side, you want to teach a man to fish, and you want to not provide a hammock for classes of people to live off the state. And on the the liberal side is the belief for a lot of people is that things happen, bad things happen to good people, and we need to have some type of safety net there. But there's I think conservatives are arguing there's room for abuse, and there are a lot of examples where people have abused the system and taken advantage of it. On the social side, especially from a libertarian perspective, there are a lot of things that you can potentially present to Democrats that might be appealing. But when you get into the government's role, as far as ensuring the welfare of the population, there are significant differences.
What do you think, Danny?
Well, that's kind of what I. That's a constant struggle between, for libertarians, we're fiscal conservative, but, we want to take care of our finances, our investments and things like that. We don't like that being taken all away because, we earned it. We understand, the responsibility that, we earned it. At the same time, we're classical liberals in a way that, we for social for social type of stuff, we shouldn't really control how a person lives their lives. You know, if a guy wants to marry, another guy, hey, it doesn't affect me. You might have, now obviously there are people who are, really into the social conservatives. Maybe it's because, they're in the works with God. And, obviously God says that, marriage should be between a man and a woman. And, them going out of this way, they might not like it. But, hey, it's their free will. It's their free choice that, these people do that. I mean, and some people can make the argument of God that, God give us free will as well. I don't know where I'm going with this, why I'm talking about God. But it doesn't really affect you and me. We make our own choices. And, I think that's all really, that's what I support. But we're kind of in the middle. Maybe some people are just not, are seeing us like flip-floppers or something. They couldn't really identify us, whether Republicans or Democrats. So maybe that's why, there's always been, a struggle for support for us libertarians. I don't know.
No, what you're saying makes sense. And I, actually, I didn't set up this clip before the show, but posted on the libertysw.org website on June 25th of last year, and it's actually John C. Dvorak off of the No Agenda show, and he illustrates really well what could be accomplished if the two sides could get together and form some type of an alliance, taking on the size and scope of government and really focusing on the individual liberties of the population in general. I'm going to go ahead and play this real quick.
Yeah, there's plenty of them. In fact, I was thinking about this recently, and the only difference between the conservative libertarians, the Ron Pauls and those types, and the progressive libertarians are essentially, there's two, if they ever can break through these two topics, there's just two topics separating these monstrous groups of progressives and conservatives. And the two topics are abortion and global warming.
Yeah.
Those two are the barriers for these two guys.
To be exactly the same.
Getting together and changing everything. But they can't. These phony topics, and I would say both of them are phony. I think the global warming thing is a distraction, bull crap, and I think the abortion argument has got nothing to do with politics.
No.
It shouldn't be in there.
And, while the two topics he alluded to may not apply to what we're talking about, I think they're, the general idea is that there are a lot of individual topics that are that the left and right are passionate about, individual liberty, civil rights, etc., that we could bring together the two sides and really make a significant difference going forward.
You know, I agree with that. I think we're looking at a situation today where we've got so much in common with the vast majority of the population. However, it is a lack of either education or willing to admit to that fact that divides us. I understand that there's a huge amount of disagreement on those two topics that he just talked about. However, when it comes down to it, when we agree on everything else, I mean, it's literally everything else when it comes down to it. I've found very few people who have beyond those two topics as being an issue that they find between each other. The political force that would be behind that group would be absolutely unstoppable. It would be phenomenally powerful.
And I think, you know, and this is really reflected in the low approval ratings for the House and Senate and for, you know, government in particular. You know, people are, you know, they just don't have a high opinion in general, either on the left or the right, as to how government is operating in the United States. And, you know, and I think you're right, Matt, this is an educational issue, which hopefully will be addressed to a certain extent by availability of information on the internet. But, you know, there is, I think, if people understand that, you know, there are significant issues associated with the expansion of the size of government, the, you know, what it takes from a tax perspective or from a debasement of the value of the U.S. dollar perspective, there, you know, as more and more people understand, you know, how those instruments are being utilized and I would argue abused by, you know, a small subset of the population, you know, you should really, and that's, you know, that's the libertarian message, is that we want to empower individuals to improve their lives, keep the fruits of their labor, and reduce the government to the role and size that was envisioned by the country's founders, which, you know, would have a, you know, beneficial impact on everyone. It doesn't matter if you're a Republican or a, you know, Libertarian or Democrat or Green Party or constitutional individual. And I think that libertarian message is powerful. And, you know, over, you know, the course of time here in the next 10 or 20 years, personally, I firmly believe that as more and more people understand that, that the libertarian message will gain strength.
Do you think it's really going to take that long?
I don't know. I'm just being generous. Or, you know, things take in politics. You know, typically things take time. Maybe it could be.
Oh, how many years did you just say? Sorry, I missed it.
Next 10 or 20 years.
10, 20 years.
Yeah.
I guess I personally hope it happens a lot sooner than that.
I don't know. That might be generous. 10, 20 years.
It takes time. You know, I think that's where you're coming from, Danny, is that in politics, nothing is really quick.
No, nothing is really quick. Nothing wants to be changed either, so I don't know. I just don't foresee that type of shift in paradigm.
Well, I mean, I guess that, right, I guess I disagree because we saw the Patriot Act passed in a knee-jerk reaction to an attack that happened on the nation. That was an incredibly huge increase on government power in a very short period of time. And I think it can happen the exact opposite direction as well, but it just takes enough education to the people to make that happen.
But we need the numbers, and I just don't see that being supportive.
You're going to make me cry, Danny.
Sorry. Just being realist, I mean, obviously the Patriot Act is passed. Now we see Obamacare is passed. I mean, you know, there's no end in sight. You know, people with this type of power, this type of authority to make all these legislative, if they see that power grows, they don't want to stop. And, you know, these are the few key individuals that holds the world's power. And, you know, if it keeps on giving them power, they're not going to want to back down. And,
You know, the only way how I see it is we need to have numbers to support that, you know, we can't let these shysters get away with it. But, you know, it's just it feels like every day everyone is okay with, most people are okay with, you know, what they have right now. So, I don't know.
Yeah, people who are comfortable with their current situation, not willing to lash out against the crap that they're being called out for, you know, or not called out for, but repressed by.
Right. Right. It's depressing.
It's a educational issue, and there's certainly from a numbers perspective, like you were talking about, Danny, and really the dominance of media outlets and the lack thereof, you know, from a liberty or libertarian perspective, you know, makes that somewhat difficult. So I can,
I'm getting pissed off at this point. Like, people, wake the hell up. What's it going to take? What is the bare minimum that people are going to put up with?
You know what? Sometimes I wonder if education is an issue, because I think a lot of people are aware of these issues. I think that's not the real issue here, because, you know, we see that, you know, right now Obama's approval rating is all-time low. And, you know, you just mentioned that Congress rating is very low. You know, people, we always hear about, you know, people, they're not supportive of the government yet. You know, I'm still questioning why they're still voting. But, you know, I think a lot of people are aware of these issues. It's just that I think the main issue with this is they're not doing anything about it. They're just like, yeah, my taxes are going up, but hey, you know what? It's like, well, what else can I do about it? You know, I still have a job, I guess, and, you know, I guess I'm okay. I'm okay with it. Yeah, it's
being complacent.
Yeah, I think a lot of it is just, yeah, like you say,
comfortable and
complacent.
Comfortable and complacent.
Right. They just don't want to take the action. You know, maybe they're fearful of what are the consequences of taking action, of doing something about it. You know, and they just don't want to deal with it. They just want to do what they do on an everyday basis and, you know, just pray and hope for the best that, you know, they make it through. And, you know, and I respect that, but it's like, you know, basically what I'm saying is, you know, it's not just education. I'm sure a lot of people are well educated with what's going on, you know, with what's going on right now, but it's just that, you know, they're just complacent about it.
No, that makes a lot of sense. So with that, I have a clip. It's longer, and we can cut it short, or we can interject within the clip. It's 13 minutes, 20 seconds. It's a Ben Swan clip from March 6th this year.
I haven't heard this yet. I'm really excited for it.
Yeah, it's pretty good. It's pretty good. It's called Truth in Media, quote-unquote, End Partisanship.
Let's hear it, brother.
All right. I'll play it. Here we go.
America is in a very tough place. Our economy is struggling, the value of our dollar sinking, our debt skyrocketing. We continue to let a mentality of aggression and suspicion interrupt the confidence that we claim to have in our freedom. The only thing bigger than these and many other problems seems to be the fact that America's two major parties, Republicans and Democrats, don't have answers. No matter which party is in power, the problems only get worse. So what if I told you the real problem is with the two-party hold on the election process, and that if we want to fix the biggest issues of our time, we must first correct the primary election system. I'm Ben Swan, and the first step toward truth is to be informed.
Intro here.
Should have something like this.
If you are a mainstream news watcher, you may have never seen this video before. It's from the 2012 Republican primary. This particular scene is from the Missouri State Convention. You see, Republican leadership didn't like the way that Republicans were voting and moved to shut down their convention and change the rules on the spot. That was a pretty wild scene. If you haven't seen it before, then you likely don't know the biggest, mostly untold story of the 2012 election. That this crazy scene where Republican voters were attempting to vote for their candidate were shut out of the process. It didn't happen only one time, and it didn't happen in only one state. This was in Arizona.
You can't do that!
Any people who know Ben Swan or Alex Jones or any of those guys, maybe let them know about this.
In Oklahoma, the lights were turned off, and Republican voters attempted to reconvene the convention in the parking lot.
I have a convention in the parking lot, and everybody is welcome to join me.
Over and over across the nation, from one state to another, from one county to another, Republican voters were locked out of their own party's process because party leadership didn't like who they were voting for. In Louisiana, the voters were so angry about the way they were being treated by the leadership of the party, they actually picked up their chairs, turned their backs on an appointed chairman in a convention because the party rules were being violated. Well, when confronted about these issues, the Republican Party took the position that they are a private club and therefore they have the right to change the rules however and whenever they like. Now, that is very important. We're going to come back to that in a minute. Now, throughout this program, we're going to give you quite a few numbers, but let's start with these. The number two. In the United States, as you know, we have only two major parties, the Republican and the Democratic parties. If you watch most national media, you would think that the country is fairly divided when it comes to politics, that there's almost this cosmic battle between the so-called left and right. In theory, about 50% of the nation is blue, Democrat, and about 50% is red, Republican. But that is not true. In fact, about 40% of voters in the United States now say they are independent voters, not affiliated with either party, including the president of independentvoting.org.
I feel very, very strongly that the system is really rigged in the direction of the political parties, and I think making membership in a political party a condition for full voting rights is unconstitutional, but also totally counter to the spirit of what American democracy is supposed to be about.
Well, Jackie isn't alone. Nearly half of all the voters in the United States are not affiliated with either the Republican or the Democratic parties. And yet there are only two options available to them. Well, why is that? Well, much of it comes back to the primary system, a system that has crippled the American electorate. Crippled it how? Well, consider this. In just about any congressional district in the country, you have either a majority of Republican or Democratic voters. Now, that happens because of either community values or because of redistricting, where parties will carve out a state to make sure they have an advantage. Within that district, on average, only 9% of voters will take part in a primary election. Now, remember, congressional and state legislative districts have been carved and then recarved and then recarved again to make sure the candidates only have to win the primary in order to win the general election. We'll crunch some numbers, and it doesn't take long to figure out that a candidate only has to pull a little more than 3% of the vote in a major party's primary in order to win the at-large seat. 3% of the vote in order to represent 100% of the constituency. How is that representative government?
Generally speaking, this small segment of the voters are the most partisan voters. And until you have politicians who are accountable to every voter in their district, you're going to end up with partisanship, and the same kind of partisanship we have now.
Well, that is why Dan and Jackie and representatives from a number of other political organizations have come together to form a new coalition called End Partisanship.
We want to end partisanship. The dominant approach, which has been to regulate campaign finance, is an ineffective and outdated mode of reforming politics.
So what specifically is End Partisanship attempting to do? Well, number one, they believe that the right to vote is fundamental. And that means...
fighting for the rights of all Americans, whether they're in a political party or not, to have full access to the political process.
And that second point is very important. Across the nation, both Republicans and Democrats have closed primaries, meaning that you have to be a registered voter within their party to be allowed to vote in a primary. So remember what I told you about 40% of voters being independents. Still others are registered Green Party, Libertarian Party, Constitution Party, Justice Party, etc. Well, that means at least half of all voters are locked out of participating in the primary vote that ultimately decides their representatives. And yet, according to Chad Peace with the Independent Voter Project, that is exactly what is happening.
My right to participate in our democracy should not be conditioned. I shouldn't have to join a party.
Now, you might say, wait a second here, man.
Don't be an independent. Don't be a Libertarian or a Green Party member.
Yep, go ahead.
That being said, I mean, that's kind of a stretch because it doesn't mean that much to head over to one of your county meetings to be able to make your point known. I mean, it's not like it's a lot of work. You don't have to join the Republican or the Democrat Party to be there. I don't actually believe I've ever signed a piece of paper that says I am a Republican or I am a Democrat. I've been deeply involved in politics for many years now. Actually, to be full disclosure, I've been an endorsed Republican candidate before, but I don't believe that I've ever signed a document that said I am a Republican. I actually don't believe that's even necessary. I think looking at the overall demographic and the split, he's splitting it up as a 40% in the middle. I'd say that's probably a little high. I don't think that there's 40% of the population that says they're not decided before the election. Only based on my own personal experience of running for office, I think that's probably a little over the top. I think there's more around 20%, something like that.
But you're also, when you ran for office, you were in a very conservative area.
So I didn't have that much. I'll be totally honest. Over the entire time that I was running for office, I probably was stopped for a decent period of time at about 10 to 20 houses.
Yeah.
People who weren't already convinced that they were Republican or Democrat, and they really had real questions for me. But overall, I'm a little hesitant to say that the influence that he's attributing to these groups is as high as what he's saying it is. I think the middle ground does still play a significant role simply because whether or not you get the endorsement from the Democrat or the Republican Party, you still have to convince those people in the middle to come over to your side.
Yep.
And saying that, your endorsement process is important in regards to getting your base, but the real fight is getting those middle ground voters. So they're still just as valuable and just as important as any other voter that you would possibly talk to, and actually more important as long as you know that you're going to get your base behind you.
Yeah,
so I disagree with what he was saying here.
I would actually agree with you. I think in a political race, the individuals that you focus on, and actually in the context of what he's talking about in this clip, are the undecided independents. You know, you don't really focus on, when you ran for office, you don't focus on the strong Republicans. To a lesser extent, you focus some on the less strong Republicans, but you don't really focus on the strong Democrats, and you focus to a lesser extent on the less strong Democrats. But where you really focus are the squishy, undecided, independent middle, right? Those are the people that
you
look to flip your way.
Exactly.
Yeah. And I think what he's saying here is that there are a lot of people who are in that camp, and you know, am I, and I agree with your assessment, a lot of these people are low information voters. You know, they just really, they can, you know, they can be swayed by a conversation with a, with somebody running for office, or they can be swayed by a, what, you know, is the most common tactic of campaigns, and that's a negative advertisement, you know, shortly before an election. You know, those are the two most common strategies used to court, you know, that type of individual. So, and I think in this video, Ben Swan is trying, or it sounds like he frames, you know, this block up as a strong, educated part of the voting population.
But that's very generous.
Exactly. I think probably Danny would agree that that's probably, you know, you would agree and Danny agree that's probably not the case.
Sorry, I agree not the case on what?
Well, that block of independent voters that, you know, isn't necessarily on either side, the Democratic side or the Republican side, it's not, it's a good subsection of that block are low information voters who are easily swayed either way.
Right. I mean, you know, all it really can take is, you know, someone to be look nice, dress nice, talk nice, and, you know, easily swayed one way. So is that what you're saying?
Yeah. And what we're listening to in this end partisanship video, they're framed up to be a, you know, a more idealistic block of voters. But I think what Matt's saying is that's kind of BS. That's not the case.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Is that what you're saying, Matt?
Yep.
Absolutely. Yep. Absolutely.
Yep. So let's continue through. And if you want to kill it, just speak up, Matt, and I'll kill it too.
Yeah, thanks for pausing that.
Yep, here we go.
Join the Republican or the Democratic Party. Make your vote count in the primary. I'm glad you brought that up. Remember the video that we started with? Video that demonstrates what happened in 2012? That is exactly the point. Over 2 million Republican primary voters attempted to do that in 2012. But state after state, the rules were changed. Sometimes, as I told you, in the middle of a convention. And remember why? Because the Republican Party insisted it could do so, claiming that it is a private club.
And this goes to the party's own arguments in court, saying, well, we have the right to tell people they can't vote in our primaries because we're private organizations. So the second cause of action is very simple. If you're a private organization, start acting like one, meaning you shouldn't be accepting taxpayer dollars, and the taxpayers shouldn't have to fund primaries if you aren't going to let everybody vote in them.
According to a report by IVN, or the Independent Voter Network, taxpayers across the nation spent approximately $400 million.
What's that
number sink?
No, I was just saying that's a really strong argument. I totally agree with that, you know, Republicans saying, yeah, you're not a member of a Republican Party. Now you can't join us. You can't, you know, participate in our activities. You can't vote for us. But, you know, we'll take your money.
Yeah, that's a really good argument. I agree.
In what way? What do you mean exactly?
Just saying that it's a whole lot of BS. It's just BS. You know, this whole primary system, whatever, that you can't vote for us because you're not a member of our party.
You have no influence over the candidate that we're going to select because you're not willing to succumb to our personal preference here. However.
Just continue the video. No, just was speaking out loud.
I had an issue here.
Oh, we got an issue.
Yeah, I might have to.
We've got technical difficulties that flow through our podcast. We make it through them because we persevere, damn it. This is the type of organization that we run, and we work all the way through every issue that we've ever had. You know, part of the thing that I find interesting about this entire argument is, I guess it's not part of the thing. It's the whole thing. You've got a situation where even when you nail it down to a Democrat versus Republican, so we're not even talking about this undecided voting group. Even when you nail it down to the Republican versus Democrat view, when we talk about the founding fathers and their intention of what the country is, the vast majority of everybody who looks at it from that perspective still agrees on the rules that they set forth. It's not like you've got a huge division among these groups on what the original intention was. It's the very small things that drop a lot of emotion that drives elections. And it makes sense. I mean, it's a religious thing. It is a prompted thing. It's very intentionally the thing that ends up in front of the public view. You've got these hugely emotional issues. Of course, that's going to be what these candidates want on the air, and the organizations behind them that want these candidates elected. They want the very divisive topics to be in the front line because it enables them to get their actual candidate that they want to vote the way that they want to elected a lot easier.
It's a way to differentiate themselves, I guess you can put it that way.
Absolutely. Eric, how's it coming?
I'm back, and we can continue with the clip if you guys would like to do that, or if you...
Yeah, let's do that.
Okay, I'll get this thing going again.
$400 million to administer party elections in 2012. The study compiled data from 9 states, which then projected across the country. The 9 states chosen, Texas, New York, North Dakota, Idaho, Tennessee, Indiana, Oklahoma, South Carolina, and Rhode Island. So to be clear, only 9% of the population on average is taking part in primary elections that are costing taxpayers $400 million. If the Republican and Democratic parties are private clubs, why aren't they paying for their private primaries themselves? If taxpayers are forced to pay for the primaries, why isn't anyone and everyone allowed to participate? So how to fix this?
So we've developed a state-by-state legal strategy defending the right of individual independent voters in the courtroom.
The state-by-state, taking on unconstitutional and unlawful control of the political process. InPartisanship has filed their first lawsuit as a blueprint in New Jersey. Well, why New Jersey? 47.6% of registered voters in that state, nearly one half, are registered in 2013 as unaffiliated voters. And yet, New Jersey requires that a voter affiliate with a political party approved by the state as a precondition to participating in the primary process. The suit seeks to protect the fundamental right to vote under the New Jersey and United States constitutions, which have no requirement that a voter forfeit their First Amendment right not to associate with a political party. By denying over 2.6 million New Jersey voters the right to cast a vote in the primary election, the state has disenfranchised, the lawsuit says, nearly half of its electorate, and thereby given private political parties and partisan voters a greater and unequal access to the voting franchise. Additionally, under the New Jersey Constitution, neither the state nor a county may appropriate money for any use of a private association.
What the lawsuit is doing is asserting, for the first time, asserting the rights of independent voters, not on behalf of a group, whether it's race-based or gender or ideological, It's just as an individual person, I ought to have the same rights as everybody else to have a meaningful vote in the political process.
So what you need to know is that a concerted effort to spread the impartisanship lawsuit to every state in the nation is now underway. But one important point should be made here. You know, this effort is not about ending political parties. It's about protecting the voter and the taxpayer from a scheme that's been put into law by politicians who are answering to party bosses and not the people they claim to represent. This effort is about opening up the political process. After all, wouldn't the Democratic position advocate for an electoral process where the most people have an opportunity to have a meaningful vote? Wouldn't the Republican position have candidates run to represent the people of the district, not members of their party's central committee? Wouldn't the Libertarian position provide the individual with a superior right to ballot access than that of
Are you guys there?
Yeah, we're here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is the second time I've had a problem.
No big deal. Yeah, it sounded like you're saying that. He was trying to emphasize something.
Oh, did it come in and out a few times?
No big deal.
Out a few times.
You know, he's making a really good set of points.
Yeah.
Basically reflects everything I've said so far.
Yeah. Yeah. For whatever reason. Yeah. Just having some issues here, but let's.
What do you think, Danny?
No, I totally agree. You know, it's just a way of, you know, enriching themselves and not really caring about what we think, what we want to do. It's just, you know, it's just them establishing a big club that is, you know, just for them and not for us. We're not in it. You know, they have their own agendas. You know, this is what they want to push forward, you know, and if we don't agree with it, you know, if we, you know, have any differences on it, you know, it's like, okay, well, we don't really care. We don't need to here, but we'll take your money. So that's how I'm interpreting this.
Right.
You know, it's a lot of BS. You know, sometimes just listening to this, you know, just make me wonder if I even should attend to that state convention. Because you know what? I still need to pay money to go there.
It's like $50 to go there. It's not like it's cheap either.
Is it $50? I should know this because I'm a delegate in.
Yeah, no, the first one I went to was $50 to get in the door.
Right, and, you know, it's like, yeah, it's $50, and then, you know, what happens? Okay, we nominate this candidate, and then chances are, you know, well, this candidate is not someone I support.
Right.
But, you know, at the same time, if this candidate gets nominated, they're still going to go to a primary.
And then you're going to get somebody like Bond Clayton who's going to stand up and cause a freaking ruckus amongst everybody else who's there. He's voted in by four people, and everybody else is, what the hell is this guy talking about?
Yeah. Why do you have a cowboy hat?
You know what? Honestly, the guys are right, I guess, in a lot of ways.
Oh,
but
yeah.
That's the kind of thing I've experienced at every convention I've been to. Is you end up with somebody who's getting attacked by like 97% of the people there, and they're trying to stand up and defend themselves, and it's not the platform or the place to do it. It ends up making a really awkward place to be.
I know exactly. By the way, Eric, I will still go to the state convention. So don't worry about that if you're thinking, you know, if I'm dropping out.
That's fine.
Did you invest in Bitcoin? So is that why you're willing to do it?
Me?
No, last time I went to the state convention, 90% of the people I talked to were talking about Bitcoin.
Should we finish up this clip here?
Yeah, absolutely, if you get it set up again.
All right.
Right to vote in our democratic republic for the people and by the people derive from the individual person. Of course it does, because the founders and framers knew that the individual's rights always trump politics. After all, humanity is greater than politics.
There it is. Nice. Humanity is greater than politics.
That's true. I totally agree with that. So,
what's your opinion, Eric?
I would agree.
I mean, politics is, you know, what they're doing this right now is all just a game, show and tell type of thing. But, you know, we disagree with it and we're not part of the game. And, you know, it's like, okay, well, then you're not part of it. Who cares about you? Who cares about what your humanities are? We'll just continue our agenda. That's what I'm hoping to see. That'll stop soon, but I don't see that stopping any time. So.
It feels so much like you're calling for common sense from people. I mean, it's not like we're asking a huge thing here. It's looking at things and evaluating them in a way that, like, everybody else in the world probably would. But since you're from America, apparently you have to have some crazy-ass opinion just based on your life experience that's led up to make you be this Democrat or Republican. You know, like, I want to be a Republican, so I can't agree with you because my dad would never agree with you. You know, you're so frustrated by that. Like, what the hell? Come on, wake up, open your eyes. It's obviously not the case. We need to just be objective. Spend 10 seconds thinking for yourself, and you recognize that this opinion is way too close-minded.
I don't know. Maybe it's just people like to hate each other. Maybe it's just fun. I don't know. That's terrible to say.
You know what? There's a lot of truth in that. I think there's a lot of people out there who just want to say, I want this other team that I can root for. I'm going to root for who I think's going to be the winning team. And the reason I say this is because I've actually experienced this before. When I was in college, there were multiple people who I freaking was a student with who said, I'm going to vote for the person who I think is going to win. They just wanted to vote for the guy who they thought was going to win, not because they thought they were right or because they represented what they believed, but just because they thought they were going to be the winning candidate. Are you kidding me? It's not a basketball game. Right. Don't be a jackass. Spend 10 minutes and learn the politics.
Right.
Oh, yeah. No, he's probably going to win, but he's going to enslave my parents, you know, whatever.
That's why, you know, it's you know, like they're emphasizing, you know, look nice, dress nice, talk nice, and, you know, chances are you're going to be able to sway in people believing you, even though it's, you know, a huge fundamental issue to what you believe in, but it's like, hey, but this guy, you know, he sounds all right.
Oh, yeah, he sounds fine.
Yeah, well, snake oil salesman, but, you know, I didn't see that.
So you guys sound a bit pessimistic on whether or not the Liberty Movement can be a positive third rail in partisan politics.
No. I actually believe that the Liberty Movement can be an extremely positive influencer. I think it's the only positive influencer between the two organizations. I think I've met people who came from the Democratic caucus and the people who come from the Republican caucus, both who believe the same things that we do. And I think we're the only ones who kind of collate the real freedom-loving opinion that the Liberty Movement comes from. I think we are that group. I don't see anywhere else to make it happen. And I think we are... we're the voice, and we need to put the effort behind making that a stronger voice. And I do believe it is making a difference. I know, the vast majority of the people who I've talked to within the libertarian persuasion, and I'm saying the Republican and the Democrat libertarian persuasion, have all said the same thing, whereas when they talk to someone who is either a Republican or a Democrat, the vast majority of the time, when you start to get down to the nitty-gritty, the actual details of what the people believe, is they end up, they do believe the same thing, And they just don't know that they believe the same thing of this libertarian organization. They don't know it's even there. They don't know it's available. They think I'm either Democrat or Republican, and they don't have this middle ground.
Or they do know about it, but they're just too weak to do anything about it. They're not willing to be one of the 300 Spartan fighters to influence what they really believe in and fight for it, because, you know, they see that, you know, the numbers are small, and it's like, you know what, I agree with you guys, but it's either going to be Republican or Democrats. And really, that's not the case. I feel like that's a lot of that is going on because, you know, like, you know, that video that he was talking about, there's a lot of independent voters that, you know, that can be swayed in either side. And I believe a lot of these independent voters, you know, have a lot of our mindset. But at the same time, you know, they know that independent parties are available, but they're not reaching out to, you know, these parties as they should, because, you know, they don't believe that it's a winnable cause. And, you know, they'd rather just sit down and, you know what, I'm going to just not going to worry about it. I mean, I will worry about it, but it's like, you know, I'm not going to make the effort to fight for it. I don't know. That's what I believe. That's what I'm thinking is happening.
Yeah, and I think there's I'm in this camp. There's a subset of individuals that think that, at least in the United States, we are in a two-party system, and the best vehicle to accomplish the Liberty Movement is looking to accomplish is through the Republican Party. And it's, you know, to me, it's been interesting to see the complete, I mean, there was a lot of enthusiasm and support in 2012 and 2008, and it's diminished substantially over the last 2 years, where people's like, well, you know, people are like, we gave it a shot. We just don't feel like, you know, our opinion has been accounted for, and that's it. I'm done.
Yeah. We'll continue living in the slave society, you know, and, you know, people are okay with that, I guess.
I don't know that they necessarily are. I think that people are upset, but they're so comfortable that they're not willing to do anything about it.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, sometimes I feel that's the way too. You know, I mean, if we compare our lives to other countries, yeah, we're really blessed. So maybe that's one of the factors why people are content with what they have, you know, and that's a fair argument, but at the same time, we shouldn't let these, you know, shizers rob us. So,
hell no,
you know,
you're the shizers.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Eric, I think you had another clip here, huh?
Yep, another clip, little discussion and wrap up, and then again next week. So I'll roll with this clip. And this is Rand Paul speaking on the moving beyond the left-right paradigm.
My man, Rand Paul.
Rand Paul.
We must stand for something so powerful and so popular that it brings together people from the left and the right and the middle.
I want you to know that there are Republicans who don't clamor for war, that many Republicans believe in a strong national defense that serves to preserve the peace.
And tell the president, tell any president, that no president will ever have the authority to kill Americans without a trial.
Damn straight. He's 100% right about that.
What he did was incredibly important. First of all, it completely scrambled that right-left way of looking at politics.
And a senator talking for almost 13 hours straight without sitting or even taking a bathroom break.
He first wanted an answer to a simple question.
Can the president use a drone strike to kill an unarmed American citizen on U.S. soil?
Charles, the words we just heard could have been uttered by a member of the American Civil Liberties Union.
This is what libertarians are like.
Libertarians like Rand Paul, conservatives who care about the Constitution, and liberals who should all agree on this.
I can't say I agree with Rand Paul about everything, but as issues go, drone oversight is one certainly worth kicking up a fuss for.
What an awesome clip, man.
Never,
that was so cool.
Never trade our liberty for any fleeting promise of security.
Do you think that's a message that's going to resonate with the Republican Party?
Oh, yes, it's definitely going to resonate.
The Facebook generation can detect falseness and hypocrisy a mile away. They want leaders that won't feed them a line of crap or sell them short. Ask the Facebook generation whether we should put a kid in jail for the nonviolent crime of drug abuse, and you'll hear a resounding no.
We should stand and loudly proclaim, enough's enough. We should not have laws that ruin the lives of young men and women who have committed no violence.
There are people in jail for 37, 50, 45 years for nonviolent crime. The last two presidents could conceivably have been put in jail for their drug use. And I really think, you know, look what would have happened. It would have ruined their lives. They got lucky, but a lot of poor kids, particularly in the inner city, don't get lucky. They don't have good attorneys, and they go to jail for these things, and I think it's a big mistake. So I think people want a little different face on immigration, frankly. They don't want somebody who wants to round people up, put them in camps, and send them back to Mexico.
In our zeal for border control, we have sometimes obscured our respect and admiration for immigrants and their contribution to America.
In fact, Sean, of all the immigration language we've tested, Rand Paul's statement about what has to be done first, second, and third, nothing tests better than this one.
Hispanics should be a natural and sizable part of the Republican base. But they've steadily drifted away from the GOP in each election. I think this says more about Republicans than it does about Hispanics.
I think the country really is ready for the narrative coming, libertarian Republican narrative. But we're becoming less and less of a national party because we don't win on the West Coast, we don't win in New England. I think people want a party that's a little bit less aggressive on foreign policy, still believes in a strong national defense, but less aggressive.
I want you to know that there are Republicans who don't clamor for war.
The young people want politicians who don't want to put them in jail for 20 years for a nonviolent drug possession charge.
And I will do everything I can to keep nonviolent criminals out of jail.
So they want a little bit different face. I think people want a little different face on immigration, frankly.
Immigrants are an asset to America, not a liability.
We should all agree on this.
Yeah, libertarian Republican narrative.
It's completely scrambled that right-left way of looking at politics.
We must stand for something so powerful and so popular that it brings together people from the left and the right and the middle.
So awesome.
I think that's true.
What a great clip. I mean, and he really does, when you talk about it in the overall perspective, there are things that can be agreed about between the Democrats and the Republicans without a doubt in my mind.
Do you think he'll run for president?
I hope he does.
I think he won't run in the next coming election. He might. I can see him trying to establish himself as a major player in the Senate. Maybe I think my gut feeling is telling me that he's not going to take the next opportunity. But he's trying to. He's waiting for the right time to get in running. But the next election might not be the one that he's going to be doing. So,
yeah, what do you think, Eric?
What's that?
Why do you have that feeling, Danny?
Oh, why?
Yeah.
I don't know. It's maybe because it's the economic conditions is obviously it looks. It looks great. It looks better on paper. He's still kind of new to politics right now. Is he like a sophomore or junior Senate? He doesn't have a whole lot of experience quite yet right now. So maybe he's trying to learn more about the process, trying to get more comfortable maybe. I don't know. That's kind of, things like that is kind of telling me. I mean, I would think that, if he's going to get into a game, he would announce it sooner rather than later. But I don't know. I could be wrong, too. So that's what I think. I don't know if this is what you guys think.
Yeah, so he's a freshman senator from Kentucky.
Freshman, okay.
Obama was a freshman senator from Illinois.
And look what look at the job he's doing right now.
Right. Apples and oranges comparison between the two, but
true.
Yeah. From what I've seen, and I think Kirk alluded to this last week, there is an organization in place, a 50-state organization in place for his 2016 presidential campaign, a paid staff in each state. All indications are he's, and it's early still, but quite a few nationwide polls, he's pulling as the highest GOP potential presidential candidate, which is encouraging.
No, I agree. I mean, he's, to me, of all the candidates that are potential candidates, I mean, he's really the only person that I think is really should be electable in terms of the GOP, unless if they put in Jeb Bush, which, I can foresee happening.
Oh, God, no.
Chris Christie or Jeb Bush.
Please don't let that happen.
Yeah. And Rick Santorum seems like he wants to run again.
No, please, just don't even bother.
Yeah. So, kind of, we're talking about bringing together various factions. Out of any politician on either side of the spectrum for 2016, specifically when talking about presidential election, Rand Paul has the best chance. But he'll get, Matt, you mentioned this last week, this is to be expected, but he'll get pretty hard for his libertarian ideology, especially by the left wing media.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, he'll be painted as some, right wing extreme libertarian crazy, much like.
Which, you know what? That is an oxymoron in my vocabulary. A right wing extremist libertarian does not make any sense whatsoever. Mm-hmm. You're so between the lines, it doesn't make sense to call any of us a right-wing extremist. We're not. We purely aren't. We are more liberal than the Democrats ever could be, and we're more conservative than the Republicans ever could be.
Fiscally, right? Yeah.
Right.
So when you're talking about the liberty movement, you're talking about a fusion, a solid fusion between all of us would consider to be the best principles on each side.
Absolutely.
But that being the case, there's a threat to, the existing system. And they will, I feel like that's just, ammunition to marginalize, the ideologies, because it is a threat against the power structure. The best way to present the argument of liberty is I've thought this for a while, is in a well thought out and persuasive manner, and in a trying to keep that conversation as calm and non-abrasive as possible, because I think a lot of people within the liberty movement get so upset because of the fact that they don't understand how something that makes so much sense is painted with a negative brush, that they fight back in a way that's counterproductive, to the goal, the larger goal that, almost everyone has is participating. That being said, Danny asked, what I thought as far as whether or not he's going to run. And I would be really surprised if he doesn't.
I hope you're right.
We'll see.
I think he's set up for the run at this point.
And we'll see. And I think out of any candidate, much like his father, there are some individuals who question his purity. But there will be, a pretty, especially among the younger voters, there'll be a pretty energetic segment of supporters, and from within the political areas that we've participated in, we'll see an influx of people back.
I hope so. Yeah. I really hope you're right, man.
Yeah. So it would really be nice, and I was discussing this last weekend, if those people would stick around and make a difference going forward, because like Danny was talking about, people have a certain level of apathy. They don't necessarily believe that they can make a change, but it doesn't take a huge number of people to make significant change, like we were talking about with the rear view cameras, etc. So we'll see how that works out.
Absolutely.
With that, Matt, it looks like it's time to wrap up.
Ladies and gentlemen, I cannot thank you enough for taking the time to be with us. As always, Liberty Southwest enjoys your company. This has been Matt Winterer, Eric Taylor, Danny Ning. Thank you all, and have a fantastic day.